Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. My guest this evening is Jack Cashill. Jack is an independent writer, author, and documentary filmmaker, or producer. Jack has written for Fortune, The Wall Street Journal, The Washington Post, The Weekly Standard, AmericanThinker.com, and regularly for WorldNet Daily. Among his many books are First Strike, Ron Brown's Body, Hoodwinked, Sucker Punch, What's the Matter with California? That's got to be a long book. And Deconstructing Obama. He has produced the scores of documentaries for regional PBS and national cable channels, including Emmy Award-winning The Rural Years. Jack is a PhD from Purdue University in American Studies, has taught media and literature at Purdue and Kansas City area universities, and served as a Fulbright professor in France. Jack's latest book is TWA 800, The Crash, The Cover-Up, and The Conspiracy. That's what we'll be talking about tonight. Jack, how are you doing this evening?
I'm doing great, and it's great to talk to you, Tim, and thanks for having me on your show.
You're certainly welcome, and thank you for coming on the show. This book you wrote, Chris, it came out the last summer, I guess for the 20th anniversary of that air disaster.
Yes, right, in July, correct, right.
And now, of course, what we're talking about here is TWA 800, and I remember it well. I remember where I was when it happened. I was getting ready to go to the beach that weekend, like many people. But
Which beach were you going to?
I was heading to the Delaware area.
Oh, okay, yeah.
But I got a phone call from a friend, and, you know, I'm thinking about the beach, and this is when I was in my 20s and single and going having fun, that sort of thing. It ruined the entire weekend. For the victims and their families, but I just got a sick feeling in my stomach. Of course, it was July 17th, 1996, at 8:19, TWA Flight 800 took off from JFK Airport, headed over Long Island towards Paris, nonstop, and it was from all accounts a beautiful summer evening. The sky was clear, so there were a lot of eyes on the horizon, on the coast, because Long Island, especially that time of year, Long Island is very heavy populated. Of course, 12 minutes later, the plane explodes in midair. All 230 people on board are killed. 16 months later, FBI announced that there's no evidence of a criminal act and closed the investigation. There was a four-year NTSB investigation that concluded the probable cause of the accident was an explosion of the flammable fuel air vapors in the fuel tank. The central fuel tank just exploded, and they guess they surmised that there was a short circuit or something, and that's where it was left. So that's what we have.
Yeah.
Now, how do you want to pick up there? The crash itself,
we can talk about. You gave a good overview of what was thought to happen and the official explanation thereof. But we do know this is that 12 minutes after that plane left JFK, off the south coast of Long Island, and your point is well made. There's literally thousands of people out on the beach that night. Or out on the docks or the harbors or the boats and whatnot, because the south shore of Long Island is a beach community, and so they're there and they're watching. And there are many hundreds, thousands of people who saw what happened. 750 of them would talk to the FBI. More important, just as importantly, I should say, or of immediate importance, was the fact that people were watching on their screens at the TRACON in Westbury, New York, where they track airplanes out of New York. And I've talked to these people. What they said they saw was an object ascending vertically on their screens, intersecting flight 800 in the second before it disappears from the screen. That was what caused the panic that night in Washington. That information, FAA information, was sent immediately to Washington, and within a half hour of the crash, Richard Clark, the anti-terror czar, was holding an emergency meeting in the Situation Room in the White House. That doesn't happen for domestic airplane crashes, very rarely, I should say, and never, actually. And that's when the panic ensued. Later on, over the next few days and weeks, the FBI would interview some 250 people who saw what they thought was a missile intersecting the airplane and blowing it out of the sky. And their accounts were remarkably constant. They were consistent, and they were thorough. Some of them, you know, were able to track the breakup sequence of the airplane before the FBI or the NTSB even knew what that sequence was. Now, what's interesting is who gets involved and when they get involved. And that's where the story gets really, really pretty murky. And it's pretty relevant to what's going on today with President Trump, for instance, questioning the CIA's impartiality.
Yes, it's something 20 years ago, but it is still relevant today because it was, I guess it was an indication that these agencies could not be trusted. The public could not trust what they were, their investigation.
Right. I mean, most of the people who work for those agencies are good people and they're patriots and they try to do a good job, but they can be politicized. And that's what happened in 1996, which was an election year with a Clinton running for White House, which meant that anything went. Especially since the media did not want to know anything the Clintons did not want them to know. Here's what happened. Is that night, I mean, within hours, the FBI was put in charge of the case, which is a problem because by law, the National Transportation Safety Board, the NTSB, was designed to take charge of those kind of crashes just to avoid politicization. The FBI is controlled by the Justice Department. The NTSB is an independent agency. So within hours, the FBI just took over. They just bullied their way in.
So completely lawless.
It's lawless because by the law, the NTSB can invite the FBI in only after they believe there's a crime that's been committed. But instead, the FBI took over. But at least they did it publicly. What was going on privately was something we've been able to unearth just in the last year or so. And that is thanks to a treasure trove of CIA documents. We now know that on day one, by their own account, the CIA involved itself, its phrase, in the missile theory, its phrase. And that's all they involved themselves with. Their role, at the end of the day, was simply to make all talk of missiles going away. And they set about doing that on day one of the investigation. We know now from these documents, Tim, that about 2 weeks after the crash, the CIA analyst sent a memo to his superior, and it was titled Hold the Presses, which was a pretty apt title, because what he was telling his superiors was that the FBI missile team had already interviewed 144 eyewitnesses that the FBI deemed, quote, excellent, remarkably consistent, and overwhelming in the evidence that a missile had taken out the airplane. This is 2 weeks after the crash. They knew this. And that's when things started falling apart. That's when the truth started taking a backseat to the politics of the day.
And, of course, this is you mentioned the politics of the day. This is 1996.
Correct.
As you mentioned, it's an election year, so that's always sensitive. But it's also more than a year after the Oklahoma City bombing.
Correct.
Ramzi Youssef is on trial.
Right. That very same day, he was in trial in New York City.
Yeah. And this
His role in Bojinka, which was the plan to blow up airplanes across the Pacific.
Yes, that's the and you also have, I believe, not too long after the Khobar Towers attack?
It was 3 weeks earlier. Khobar Towers in Saudi Arabia had been blown up, killing, like, I believe it was 19 American servicemen. So there was a lot in the air at that time, a lot of, talk of terrorism. And part of it was, that we'll find out that it wasn't really terrorism, but the fear of it being that the Clintons wanted nothing to do with a terror attack in a run-up to the election, because it could undo them, much as it might have undone Barack Obama and Benghazi in 2012. And that's why lying became the practice du jour. I mean, they had no hesitance about making up stories to protect their political interests.
Yeah, because he was running a what's called a peace and prosperity campaign, stay the course type of thing. Yeah,
right, exactly.
Yeah,
and if Flight 800 is shot out of the sky, there goes peace and there goes prosperity, possibly because the airplane industry is going to be crippled. People can live with a bomb, but the idea of a missile knocking planes out of the sky over New York, especially 2 days before they started the Olympics, has real frightening implications.
Now, of course, the official explanation was a central fuel air, central, you know, fuel tank explosion caused by a, presumably by a wire, which, from what I understand, from your investigations and others, has said that that wire wasn't even in the aircraft at the time, correct?
No, no. It's a spark of unknown origin. They never were able to come up with even a plausible scenario. In fact, after my book came out, Tim, you know, I got literally hundreds of emails from professionals within the industry, and many of whom worked on the investigation. And the most outraged came from people who worked on the in the fuel tanks. They said, this is crazy. This can't happen. You know, Boeing knew that. Everyone knew that. And but nonetheless, they were, you know, the media weren't prepared to ask questions about it.
Now, there were a few reporters that did ask questions and then were, I guess, subsequently fired for asking.
Yeah, I mean, the one guy, for instance, asked a question, which was a legitimate question, at a press conference. And I talked to several people who were there. He asked, how can the Navy be holding this press conference when they're likely suspects in this, you know? And they just dragged them bodily out of the room when he asked the question. They were playing hardball. And the media at that time, this is just before social media, they never could have gotten away with this today. But at this time, only about 10% of the people in America were online. And the majors still controlled the dynamic. And the net result was that they could, you know, say what they want and get away with what they want.
I guess with this case also, yet another case that exposes media collusion.
Yes.
You know, with government agencies, CIA, FBI.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's and you know, they couldn't have gotten away with this today. Simply couldn't have. They couldn't have gotten away with it for, you know, a variety of reasons. But most notably, that the witnesses would have started talking to each other. At the time, they didn't know that there were, you know, one witness, and each witness thought he was alone because the media weren't reporting them. What's curious is that a week after the, 2 weeks after the CIA persuaded the FBI to not go forward with its report on the attack, the FBI talked to the New York Times for the first time. And what they said was that there was only a handful of eyewitnesses. Now, remember, 2 weeks earlier, they were saying that there were 144 excellent eyewitnesses. Now we're down to a handful of eyewitnesses. And these eyewitnesses weren't sure what they saw, and it's most likely that they saw a bomb, because that was the scenario they were selling at that point. So the readers of the New York Times did not know that there were any eyewitnesses. And the other eyewitnesses didn't know there were other eyewitnesses. So when you have that kind of control, you can get away with literally murder.
And some of these eyewitnesses, I think you wrote that they were sort of gaslighted by the FBI.
Yeah, right. Oh, sure, they did. They would go back to them and tell them, "Oh, you didn't think you see what you really thought you saw, did you?" And then in several cases, as I show in the book, is that the CIA made up, literally manufactured out of whole cloth, second interviews with these key eyewitnesses that never took place, and we can prove it.
This was
at least three cases, three major eyewitnesses.
Yeah, one what stuck out to me was witness 73.
Yes.
When they I guess they suggested she might have been drunk or something, and then
yeah, they're right. They said she had drank two Long Island iced tea cocktails. Well, when I talked to 73 some years later, you know, she told me started with, she goes, "I don't even know what a Long Island iced tea cocktail is." Well, and it's even worse than that, because she said, "I didn't drink, and I don't drink at all." And then she said, there was no second interview. And then I found that there were several eyewitnesses for whom that was true. Key eyewitnesses, the one that the CIA built its final scenario around. They had to make up entirely fresh and new eyewitness statements for them and enter them in the record. It was shameful. In fact, it's one of the most corrupt things I've ever seen our government do.
So they were, I guess, what they were submitting false 302 reports.
Yeah.
Which
in some cases, they would write out new 302s. In some cases, they just, you know, circumvent the 302s and just, you know, drop new information in the file.
Mm-hmm. Now, Chris, you mentioned there are hundreds of witnesses who saw an object moving towards the aircraft, eventually intersecting with the aircraft. I think one described it as an upside down Nike swoosh.
Yeah, that was Witness 73, and
Okay.
she was one out of many. They all said the same thing. They
Yeah.
basically saw an object come up off the horizon, burning red tips, smoky contrails, zigzagging out to sea, arcing over at the last second, then blowing the plane out of the sky. And some of them, like Witness 73, were able to say in detail how the plane disintegrated in the sky, nose blowing off, right wing coming off, et cetera, before the FBI was able to determine the validity of that through its examination of the debris field. So, yeah, it was it's shameful. I would consider it the most successful cover-up in American peacetime history.
Now, with you mentioned the debris field, and that the way the debris field was laid out in a way that's consistent with the testimony of the eyewitnesses, meaning their eyes weren't lying to them; they saw what they saw.
Right, exactly.
And well, you also have more evidence of a cover-up was the flight data recorder and the black box.
Yeah.
And what were the problems with those in this case?
Well, there's a couple of problems. One is that, and other than the bodies, the first thing that the recovery team goes for are the so-called black boxes. Actually, they're bright orange, but one is the flight data recorder, and the other is the cockpit voice recorder. And they can, in almost every case, tell you what happened, what went wrong, both in the cockpit, from the voices of the pilots who are describing their undoing, and from the data. Well, even though this plane crashed 10 miles off the coast of the Hamptons in 120 feet of calm water in the middle of the summer, it took allegedly the Navy a week or more, about 8 or 9 days, to recover the black boxes. They said they couldn't find them. They said they must have been damaged. Well, they weren't damaged. But when they found them, and I've seen the videos of them finding them, and the guys, the divers went down and found them, were, trying to do a good job, but they weren't privy to what was going on. They were just sitting at the on the bottom of the ocean floor like the hassock in your living room. You could just tripped over them. And amazingly, both of them said nothing at all. There was no relevant data on either one of them. There was no noise out of the cockpit. I mean, if there's a mechanical failure, almost inevitably, pilots know about it some seconds or at least even minutes or hours before the plane crashes. In this case, there was nothing in the flight data recorder. And the audio experts I've talked to fully believe that they had been edited. They had been taken initially, like within a day, taken someplace and had the critical problem information edited out of them.
Which would explain the inexplicable delay in retrieving them.
Yeah, right,
Yeah,
exactly.
yeah. And they claimed there was like rough seas or something, which of course wasn't the case, from what I understand.
Yeah, correct, because they said it was rough, but the local divers were there said, this is crazy. We've been going in, people diving clubs have been going in every day. And the distinctive pingers, relate to where the boxes are. Would they pe the people went out there the first night heard them. It wasn't a mystery.
Now, getting into the crash itself, or the not crash, but the explosion itself, from what I've read, is it just doesn't seem to follow a central explosion, because apparently the from the wreckage, the entrance there's an entrance hole and an exit hole in the hull, I believe. And I think is the exit hole bigger than the entrance hole?
Well, and in fact, there's no definitive holes, and
Okay.
that was, and in fact, there's no, it's very possible that a missile did not technically hit the plane, because you have these proximity fuses that blow up near the plane and cause enough trouble. They could destabilize the fuel tank and vaporize it, so that, they would have to, that it could cause literally cause any spark could cause it to blow. So, I mean, that part of it might be actually legitimate, but there was no real physical evidence of a that anyone was allowed to see, certainly, that of a missile hitting the plane. Now, here's the trick was, too, is that evidence that was found to have explosive traces on it, and many pieces were found to have that, they were testing positive at the Long Island testing site, were then sent to the FBI lab in Washington, never to be seen again, something like 116 pieces. And I've talked to several of the investigators who worked on it and said, hey, you know, we'd see it tested positive, and then we'd say, you know, what's going on here? And that's all, we had to send it out for further testing. Except that the testing device they had in Long Island was the most sophisticated device they had in America. It was just a good way to launder evidence and to launder pieces of information.
So it's 100. You're saying 116 separate pieces of evidence,
yes,
but missing,
right,
at the FBI lab.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, I think a while back you co-wrote a book with this Sanders.
Yes, James Sanders, right.
James Sanders, and he, I guess, was put onto the story. He was a reporter by his wife, who was a TWA employee, and he retrieved a sample of foam residue that I guess he independently got the evidence, and it came out positive for RDX, I think it was. Was it RDX?
It was for, you know, some. It was consistent with missile residues. And
okay.
So what they did is, you know, he had it tested. He had a source inside the investigation. It was the lead 747 manager and pilot, who was a straight arrow kind of guy, who told James, first time he met him, hey, there's a cover-up going on, you know. And they, you know, they worked together to try to expose it. And as a result of their efforts, James, the pilot, Terry Stacy, and James's wife, Elizabeth, were all arrested and tried for conspiracy and convicted. And the wife's contribution was to introduce her pilot husband, her husband, the investigative reporter, to the pilot who was, to the pilot. And that was it. And they were both Sanders were tried in the federal court in Long Island and convicted. And, you know, they didn't put him to send them to prison because that would have been just too embarrassing. So they basically what they did was to put him on probation. Sanders was on probation for 5 years as a result of this, as a result of just trying to honestly get at the information that was inside the investigation.
This was for getting a small piece of foam, for which there was a lot of,
Yes. Oh, yeah. There was 100 pieces of foam they could have pulled from, 1,000 pieces. They just took a pinch.
And at his trial, his lawyer could not mention that he was an investigative reporter?
That's right. Couldn't tell him he was a reporter. So they were tried as, like, common thieves. And they got away with it, and partly because at that time there was no alternative media to counter them,
Yeah, New York Times isn't going to write about it, are they?
No, New York Times was totally in the tank, and according to New York Times, there was only one eyewitness worth talking to, and he thought he saw a bomb, And I've tried to talk to the New York Times since then. I tried to talk to them this summer. They don't want to know. They know they screwed up. I mean, or screwed up or allowed this to happen or, it's not like they sat down and conspired to tell the false story. It's just that they were dependent on the FBI for all their information, and they went with what they were told.
Yeah, you also write about this guy, Mike Wire, that Reed Irvine tracked down. That's an interesting story.
Right. Yes, it is. Wire was the man around whom the CIA built its case-closing animation, in which the CIA argued that what happened was that the plane was just flying along peaceably, the nose blew off from an internal explosion. Then the plane, with the nose blown off, tilted backwards and rocketed up for about 3,500 feet, confusing people into thinking they saw a missile. And they built this animation around the perspective of Mike Wire. Wire was working on a bridge in West Hampton. He had no idea at the time that it was his perspective that they were, and his story and his viewpoint that they were allegedly relating. Well, when Reed Irvine found his way to Wire, only because Wire's name, W-I-R-E, is a common name, and they forgot to redact it at one point. And so that Irvine was able to find him, and then we went to Wire, and it was just like Witness 73. And he said, why did you change your testimony with that second interview? He goes, there was no second interview, Because Wire said, he said, I saw him off the water. He came off the horizon, It's remarkable that they've gotten away with this. And you would think, Tim, with a story this compelling, that I could walk into 60 Minutes or I could walk in the New York Times or walk the Washington Post and they'd be eager to tell it or to retell it. But they're not. They don't want to know anything about it.
Yeah, it's almost the exact opposite. The more meaningful the story is, the more impactful,
Yeah.
the less
Yeah.
interested the mainstream media
Right.
is.
The more evidence I have, I have no doubt I'm right. It's not like I think I'm right or I might be right. I have no doubt I'm right. And
Well, I mean,
that is.
all the evidence suggests an explosion caused by an external force, and the
Yes.
government comes up with this. The tank exploded. We don't know why. Enough
Right,
said.
exactly.
Makes no
Yeah.
sense. Yeah,
Yeah.
and you also have a witness, Hank Hughes, a NTSB investigator who saw
Yeah, he was
FBI.
like a senior investigator on the thing, and he's since come around and said, well, yeah, listen, he is now totally supporting the people who believe that a missile struck the plane. Because he saw the evidence being corrupted while he was working on the investigation for the NTSB. And he was in charge of reconstructing the plane. It wasn't like he was just a low-level employee. And there are at least a half a dozen major whistleblowers from within the investigation who have come forward and said, no, we need to reopen this. This is a crock, you know? And yet the NTSB won't reopen it, and nor will FBI or the CIA. CIA, they don't know nothing about it. It's just really bad. And it's I wish I could be more optimistic about the way the government works. But when I see the CIA being criticized for politicizing information, I say, hey, I could prove they did that in 1996. Why
Yeah.
wouldn't they do that in 2016? Especially since the head of the CIA, John Brennan, was an Obama guy, you know?
Yeah. And you also, I think there's a care a man, Danziger, the lead investigator, who said that periodically during the investigation, the FBI would clear everyone out of the hangar, inciting
Yeah.
national security issues. Now,
Right.
what you know, if the cause was the central fuel tank explosion, what national security issues were at stake? It made no sense.
Well, what was the FBI doing on an investigation if it wasn't a crime?
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. If it was a fuel tank explosion, what was the FBI doing involved in the case, you know? What was the CIA doing involved in the
That's the
case?
question I
And
always had.
here's the weird thing, Tim, is that in 1995, and the notorious Wall memo was written by Jamie Gorelick, who was the head of actually the de facto head of the Justice Department. Jan Arino, her boss, was a figurehead. And the Wall memo prevented the CIA and the FBI from sharing information. The Wall memo, as we learned in the 2004 9/11 hearings, several people, including George Tenet, John Ashcroft, etc., cited as the main reason for 9/11, because the FBI and the CIA weren't allowed to communicate. And yet the CIA and FBI worked hand in glove on the 800 investigation, not to get at the truth, but to suppress the truth.
Yeah,
Now,
yeah.
most of the people who worked for the FBI had no idea this was going on. I'm not even sure that the head of the FBI investigation, Jim Kallstrom, knew what was going on. I just talked to him a few weeks ago. It was a bizarre phone call, but you have to say.
I think you've mentioned that he probably just told, he probably said it's national security, do it for your country, don't ask any questions.
That's what I
Yeah.
thought. But, you know, and after talking to him, I think he was just in so far over his head and he lost control of the investigation, they took it away from him.
Well,
And then he just went along to go along or whatever. I don't know. I mean,
with that much
it
at
was, it
stake,
was,
yeah.
yeah.
I mean, who knows what
Yeah,
threats were
he,
made? I mean,
well, sure, right. And one breakthrough I did have is I was able, this is after the book came out, I was able to identify this FBI agent who was the head of the missile team, who refused to yield to his bosses or to the CIA and made a very spirited defense saying the CIA has to rethink everything it said to this point. This was after the head of the CIA, George Tenet, and the head of the FBI investigation, and Louis Freeh, the head of the FBI, had signed off on the fuel tank theory. I identified him by name. I talked about him. I tried to contact him and didn't hear from him. About 2 weeks before the election, a week or so before the election, I get an email from him. He said, "Jack, you are absolutely on the right track. Thanks for doing what you're doing. But I just, you know, I have a new family and I just changed jobs. I can't go public right now, you know."
Yeah.
And so, what you find throughout the government is the fear of retaliation. You know, I talked to air traffic controllers. The one who was at the who what witnessed it that night said, "Listen, even now," he goes, I can't use my name because I have dependent children, you know? They'll come and get me." The fear of losing their pensions, of losing their jobs, of losing their freedom still haunts the people who were involved in the investigation.
Yeah, I don't hold them in judgment. I understand that.
Yeah.
That's I don't demand anyone to be a martyr. I don't. That's
No.
not for me to do. I
Especially if
don't.
they don't think there's anyone who's going to listen to them other than like me,
Well,
or
that's
you,
true. It'd be
Yeah.
if the public would rise up and there'd be a spirit of defense and the media would stand up behind these people, they'd have a chance instead of being
Yes.
isolated and being unemployed and maybe
Right.
sometimes even worse.
Right.
That's yeah, that's what happens. And I think in this case, didn't Bill Clinton actually sign an executive order waiving whistleblower protection in this investigation?
Yes, that's exactly right for any Navy special forces, which means anyone who is likely involved in retrieving those black boxes, you know?
Yes.
So, yeah, and that was his only fingerprints on the campaign, on the whole investigation. So it's, yeah, it was a strange deal, an unfortunate deal, and they're still getting away with it, which is really tragic.
Now, of course, you mentioned Jamie Gorelick. That's an
Yeah.
interesting. She played a p apparently played a key part in the cover-up,
Yes.
and she was handsomely rewarded for her efforts, right?
Oh, to say the least. She was the deputy attorney general under the Clintons, and she was their person. As I mentioned earlier, Janet Reno was sort of a figurehead, and the Clintons worked around her. So what happens with Gorelick is that she's the one who writes the wall memo, by the way, and she not only writes the wall memo preventing the CIA and FBI working together on terrorism, but then she oversees their cooperation on Flight 800 suppression, you know? So that happens after the investigation is pretty much put to bed. After about, 6 months, 8 months, she gets the most plum job in Washington. She's named the vice chairman of Fannie Mae. In this job, according to the New York Times, she'll make $25 million in the next 6 years, even though she has no relevant experience for the job, right? Then at the end of 6 years, she steps down to take a position on the 9/11 commission, one of only five Democrats on the commission, right? I mean, it's just so wrong and so obvious, and yet she got away with it, and the Clintons got away with it, and no one wanted to say anything. The media were silent on it, and that was that.
Yeah, I guess Fannie Mae, that's kind of a sinecure that people go. I think political hacks get when they've done their job well. And was
Yeah,
that
no. Fannie Mae is a major, major reward because, in other words, the average good job in Washington pays a couple hundred thousand a year. This one's paying $4 or $5 million a year,
Yeah. Who
And
was that?
Fannie
Who?
Mae is a public corporation
Yeah.
with a board, but the board is all Clinton appointees.
Yeah, it's
They
very
had to
political.
wire, hardwire that appointment for her,
Yeah.
and it's shocking and it's painful, and she still has all that money in the bank,
Yeah, Inc. Yeah, it's like that and Freddie Mac too, I think, are pretty much run the
Yeah,
same way. Very,
right.
very
Yeah, it's pretty.
political. And
Yeah.
I think it was Franklin Raines, I think, who
No, Franklin Raines, yeah, probably even made more than Fannie Mae than even Jamie Gorelick did. He was the chairman
Yeah,
during the glory years when they were milking the public for millions,
he was central, played a big part in the in a lot of the housing crash and all that because of the
Oh,
mortgages and all
yeah,
that. Yeah,
right.
but
Right.
yeah,
So
but he.
she Jamie Gorelick was the mistress of the destruction. I mean, everything she touched turned to ashes,
So yeah, so she was well rewarded for her efforts.
Yeah.
Now, also another thing was kind of bothered me was the reasons given for the disaster was the tank explosion.
Yes.
But I don't recall any lawsuits from victims or victims' families.
Well, the families were paid off, instantly. See, the thing is, it was an act of terror. The families would not have necessarily received anything, other
Okay.
than. But what happened was that, and it's not like the families were paid off. I mean, that they, if you lose a kid, you're not going to
Oh,
settle
I know,
for it. I
yeah.
mean,
Yeah.
but what happens is that the trial lawyers get in there right away and they insinuate themselves and they convince the families that it was, that the real problem, the real terrorists weren't wearing turbans. And they said this. They were wearing suits and they worked for TWA and for Boeing, blah, blah, blah. And they were looking for answers, and the trial lawyers were the ones who provided it. They got a big payoff. Boeing didn't have much of a choice because they were at that time involved in a merger with McDonnell Douglas, which gave them control of the the entire control of the domestic airplane production market, you know. So they had a rollover, and TWA was on, you know, was teetering at the time, and they needed all the government help they could get, and they rolled over. You know, you'd like to think that, you know, that they would have stood up, and I've heard from, you know, everyone I know at TWA, and I did my book TV presentation at the TWA Museum, and so I've talked to literally hundreds of TWA employees, all of whom are on my side. We're horrified by what happened. I've gotten countless emails from engineers at Boeing saying the same thing. Mm-hmm. But and they're all appalled, but they're all, you know, they're just not in a position to, even if they wanted to talk, no one's going to listen to them, you know?
Okay. You alluded to in the beginning is actually, a couple points was interesting. I think I've heard you mention is that the day of the attack or the attack, missile attack, I guess. MSNBC was only on the air for a few days. Actually, ran a videotape of the actual incident.
That's exactly right. And I've talked to 100 people who've seen it. And my best witness is a guy who is a 747 pilot who was laid up in Hong Kong having back surgery, and his wife came to join him. In Hong Kong, in the United States, they pulled the video after a couple of airings. And I know a guy who was in the room when they pulled it. But in Hong Kong, they obviously didn't get a control of that copy, and he watched it, he said, 50 times. Because he describes in exquisite detail exactly what he had seen, you know? And what they saw, he saw what everyone else said they saw, you know, the object coming up. It was on the video, the object coming up off the horizon, burning tip, contrail, out the sea, zigzagging, arcing over, blowing up the plane, right? You see that? He said, we saw it 50 times at least, he and his wife. His wife attested the same thing. You know, he lent me his name. He said, I'll go public with this. You want to hear about it? You know, I've talked to the guy who was working that night in MSNBC. He will not go public under any circumstances. He's still afraid. But, you know, it's out there. Nelson DeMille wrote a very good novel around that missing video. It's called Nightfall, and I would recommend people who want a, you know, a good thriller. And Nelson DeMille's, you know, a New York Times bestseller. I would recommend that they take a look at that, and because it really, you know, it really, he comes to the same conclusion I do.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think you've the chief, the two chief theories of what really happened is it's either terrorism or a military exercise gone wrong.
Yeah.
And I, from what I understand, you think that it was probably the U.S. Navy that took the plane down accidentally.
Yeah, I would say.
An exercise.
You know,
Right.
I would say, even though I don't want to come to that conclusion, it seems inevitable. I mean, I would say the evidence is overwhelming, and that's what happened. Yeah.
Now, you had an interesting story, I think, with your friend Sanders, that he thought he had gotten a hold of a videotape of the incident, of the impact. I guess you proved that it wasn't, because something you proved it with the moon.
Yeah, you know, it's odd. That's a good story because,
yeah.
You know, James Sanders has been relentless in pursuing this over the last 20 years, you know, and because he's on probation, 5 years, they've wrecked his life. And then he calls me about a year or so and goes, Jack, you won't believe it. I did this FBI, you know, Freedom of Information Act request, and I got the video. I said, the video? He goes, yeah, the video of the missile attack, blah, blah, blah. So he said, oh, send me a copy. So he sends me a copy. By that time, I was pretty deep into my research on the new book. And then I had to call him back. I said, James, boy, I hate to break it to you. I'm the only person in America who could tell you something you don't want to hear. He goes, what's that? He goes, it's not the video. I said, this is a video from July 12th. We knew that this video existed. We'd read about it. We'd never seen it. It's a video of a missile test off the coast of Long Island taken on July 12th. He goes, how do you know it's July 12th? I said, I checked the moon, you know. In the era of the internet, there's a thing called moon page. You can go, it tells you exactly where the moon was at that time of day, you know.
Yeah.
And I said, our moon, the moon on July 12th was waxing. This moon's waxing. The moon on July 17th is waning. They're both new moons. They're both, you know, roughly the same dimension. But one's covered and one's governed. And this is what it is. And then he took a look, and then he conceded, yeah, okay, you're right. But
yes.
That video had tons of evidentiary value, because what we see is not only a rocket going up, and the guy who's taking, an amateur who's taking this video, he says, hey, look at a rocket going up, you know. even says it. And the FBI knew it. We knew about the video. We knew that the Defense Intelligence Agency had reviewed the video and conceded that it was looked entirely like a rocket going up. But what they don't mention in the emails or the memos is that you also see a flaming object coming down. This was obviously a test. I mean, whatever they shot at it, they could have shot at another missile or a drone or something and knocked it out of the sky, and it was burning and came down. Then through the CIA documents, we also found out there was a test on July 7th. So you had, you know, missile firings on the 7th, 12th, and 17th. And you don't have to be a mathematician to know, to see the sequence there, you know?
Yeah, it'd be 5 days. There you go.
Yeah.
Now, what exercise was allegedly being run on the 17th then?
Well, this is where the mystery is still, you know, the Navy has been utterly, totally, thoroughly silent on this. You know, they've gotten away with it. I don't know the exact nature of the test, but I do know the real giveaway is that right above Flight 800 when it blew up was a Navy P-3 Orion, which is used as the communication tool in these missile tests. And that, this has been public information at that time. There's no reason for the media not to have known this. So the P-3 would coordinate information between combatants in a missile test, that is the various ships that were out there. And the P-3 was hovering right above Flight 800 when it got blown out of the sky. And, you know, this is what I talked to Kalshman about. I said, you mean to tell me that was an accident? You know, it's just coincidence that just happened to be there, you know? And he didn't even know about it. I mean, I don't think he knows enough to...
Yeah.
Anymore. He doesn't want to know any more than he wants to know. And, it was a test. It had gone awry. The plane was kept at a lower altitude than anyone anticipated to let another plane pass overhead. There was probably a drone involved. There was a photo of a drone running in the New York Times. So it was, it was a complicated maneuver. There's an element of recklessness involved because, you know, they're awfully close to the coast on a busy airspace. But at the same time, you know, if they were testing what they call cooperative engagement capability, and they were seriously worried about a missile attack on the American, or, you know, like even what we saw on September 11th, planes as bombs attack on New York, they had to be able to do it in a contested airspace, and which may be the reason why they were contesting, why they were testing it where they were.
Yeah, they had to create real life scenarios as much as possible to test the system.
Yes, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, because if you can't do it there, you know, where can you do it, you know?
Now, you've also, I heard you answer a question, I think a while back, on the Hagman report.
Yeah.
And they posed a question about, you know, a cover up this big would require lots of people, which, you know, if you think about it, really doesn't
No.
Top-down command system compartmentalized is actually fairly simple if you have the right people in place. But you made a good point. Is in answering that question, you talked about how sailors don't talk about exercises, tests, especially ones that go wrong.
They don't even talk about the ones that go right. You know.
Yes. Yeah. So that's how that can happen. Very, especially in the military.
Yeah. Right.
But also, wasn't there also a vessel that was sent down that you surmise was part of the either communications that was then sequestered and sent down to the Caribbean or something and get out of the area?
Yeah, I talked to one sailor who told his story to me, and he said that his he did not believe that his he believed fully that his plane, his ship was involved in the test, but was not the ship that fired the missile.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened, though, is that they immediately afterwards that they were they just fled the area, went to Bermuda, weren't allowed to leave the ship. And then I checked the history of that ship, USS Carr, and it has no history for that 6 months. It's just missing. It's just there's no record for it. It's like it disappeared. That was one sailor who was willing to come forward. I've talked to others who won't, you know, give me their name or their, you know, there's a lot of people who will give you a little bit of information, but not much. And, you know, you can't really trust it or fully, fully commit to it. But there's a lot of information out there like that, and it's troubling when you see it, and it adds up. And the cumulative effect is that I have absolutely no doubt the plane was shot down. And only I'd leave 1% wiggle room that it was something other than a Navy test gone awry.
Now, you also have, you know, of course, this is a heavy trafficked area, not only in the air, but in the sea. And so when this occurs, a lot of people are watching this probably in horror, amazement and horror, actually witnessing something like this. The ships in the area, of course, following maritime protocol, rush to the scene to see if they can provide any aid. Now, I understand is there was one vessel, which is still unnamed, that sped away, which is a complete violation of maritime protocol.
Right, and it was speeding away, and it was big enough to be picked up on radar, and it was speeding away at 30 knots, which means it was a major ship. And the curious thing is, of course, that FBI was able to identify every single other ship, but they conceded they couldn't identify the ship, right? I mean, it's just too much. It's too much to comprehend and to believe and to take seriously.
Yes. And now, again, you have, looking at all the evidence, there's simply no way to come to any other conclusion, I think, with all the evidence we have available, that it was taken down by some form of missile. And
yes.
The fact that, we do have record of a military exercise going on there. And you have what the sailors have told you and these things. Yet, even to this day, it's 20th anniversary that there's no mention in the mainstream press about any reconsideration of the final conclusion of the investigation that was released back in 2000, right? And there's
right. And in fact, what happened is that after the book came out, one of my great supporters was a fellow named Vernon Gross, who was a former board member of the NTSB. There's only five members of the NTSB board, so it's really a pretty prestigious position. And he's totally on my side. And he arranged a lunch for the three of us, he, I, and the chairman, current chairman of the National Transportation Safety Board. Now, the chairman didn't know I was going to show up at his luncheon, but nonetheless, I was there. And I talked to him. I gave him a copy of the book. He knows about it. He claims to have read it. And yet they would not budge. I mean, he's just pure bureaucrat. He's a Democrat too. And what was curious about him, I had never met him before. His name's Chris Hart. I did know that in 93, when Clinton took over, he replaced Hart with this hack politician from Tennessee named Jim Hall and made him chairman of the NTSB. Well, I did know that Hart was an astrophysicist from Princeton and with a law degree from Harvard. I did not know that Hart was both black and a Democrat. So think about Clinton's move in 1993 to throw off the board a totally qualified black Democrat and replace him with an unqualified white political hack whom the New York Washington Post described as his best credential was his driver's license. and it is astonishing that that the Clintons were so political and they thought so far ahead that you never knew when they were going to need someone to plant on one of these boards. And it might, it's like the Godfather, when he's talking to the funeral director. Right? So, Buona sera, one of these days I'm going to come to you. I'm going to need some help,
And you can't have an honest man in there. How do you work with a guy like that?
Yeah, right. So they had Jim Hall, and then they had another Clinton guy, Bob Francis, so the second guy in the NTSB who managed the investigation. And they put him in. So those are the two guys running the show, And that's all it's like.
Yeah, how this can get covered up. I think you also mentioned, heard you mention in an interview about equating it to the Vincennes incident, where the accidental shooting down of the Iranian Airbus.
Yeah, I mean, that can happen, right? Yeah, and what happened there was, this was happened in 1988. We accidentally shot down a passenger plane in the Persian Gulf. And because these systems are fallible, they're extraordinarily complex, and it's very possible for someone to misfire. And it happened then. What happened then to the pilot, the captain, rather, was he was sent back to teach at some naval training school. And that's what happened to the captain of the USS Carr, by the way, the one, the plane, the ship that I talked about earlier, the ship that went missing. So, you know,
that's interesting.
I'm at a loss to understand all this. I sure wished him that some like major authority would come to my rescue and, you know, and help me out here. But so far that isn't happening.
But you also mentioned Admiral Crow or Crow.
Yes. Crow. Yeah. He's a case because he was the head of the, I guess he was the chief admiral in the Navy at the time. And he was being grilled in 1992 by Democrats who controlled the House about the Vincennes incident. And then, you know, when they threatened more hearings and more punishment and more scrutiny, Crow makes this pilgrimage to Little Rock and out of the blue endorses Clinton for the presidency. He's the first major military person to do that. He's rewarded, you know, with the, like, he ends up becoming ambassador to England. the Vincennes incident goes away, and everyone's happy except for the 230 poor souls on the board TWA Flight 800 and their families, many of whom I'm still in contact with and whom are still, you know, fuming about this whole thing.
Mm-hmm. And, yeah, Crow, of course, yeah, endorses Clinton.
Yeah.
And which is a big thing because the, you know, the military issue with Clinton in 1992 was rather
sure
sensitive.
Right. No one was. Yeah. And the Vietnam, and Crow, issue. Not only that, then he writes an editorial in the New York Times, praising Clinton's vision and whatnot. This was the same Crow who several months earlier was being roasted by the future Secretary of Defense, Les Aspin. And that's the way that it broke in 96. And without an alternative media then of any consequence, they were able to do and say what they wanted to do and say, you know?
And I think, I guess that how you describe it, you've referred to it as his Clinton. This was Clinton's Benghazi moment. And
yes.
Of course, we've experienced a similar cover up with Benghazi. Although it hasn't been quite as effective because of the alternative media, although, you know,
right.
ultimately Obama was reelected. And it was,
yes, he was, but it, yeah. it made it, and that happened far away, and only four people were killed.
Yeah.
But seriously, I think, I wrote about this as I was on 3 years ago, a very good documentary came out on TWA Flight 800 that I wasn't involved with, but it was excellent. And even the major media had to pay attention to it. And I was invited on CNN to talk about it. And at the end, you know, they said, I just said it was one of those 5 minute things. And they said, okay, Jack, okay, who did it? Why the cover-up? I said, why? You only give me 1 minute. Let me just say, why the cover-up? I said, this is Bill Clinton's Benghazi moment. I said, he's on the verge of winning a national election. And the next thing you know, he's got this major national security disaster, which has a chance to scotch the whole deal. And he panicked. And he decided to kick the can down the road past November and just hoping that he could, you know, that after November something could be worked out. But once you start kicking that can down the road, it's gone. You can't kick it back. And so Alison Kozik says, well, thank you, Jack. This is on CNN's Good Morning Show, whatever it was. And then next day I look at the transcript and my answer has been edited out, right? Just gone.
Hmm.
This is how thorough they yes. are, you know?
Yeah, yeah. They'll edit things that make you sound, you know, either make you sound, you know, inarticulate, stupid, or clumsy. And
oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And so the transcript is there and then you know, she asked the question, the next thing I'm going, okay, well, thanks, Allison. And we have Allison signing off. It wasn't like they just truncated the end of it. You know, it jumps right from, you know, before I was asked that question to her signing off. That whole segment just out of the transcript. You know, there's no reason for that.
And so the transcript itself, again, the transcript itself will go down in history as, you know, what was said in that interview. But guess
yeah.
what? You can't rely on these
transcripts. Well, you know, what happened is that here's what happened, though, is I wrote an article about CNN pulling it, and then there was enough pressure put on CNN that they finally put it back in. And then, you know, it was July 17th, and the 19th anniversary of Flight 800, either the Russians or Ukrainians shot a passenger plane out of the sky, you know?
Yeah, I remember. Yeah.
It was on July 17th, right? The 19th anniversary. And Anderson Cooper says that night when he's talking about it, he goes, you know, this is 19 years ago today, TWA Flight 800 was shot out of the sky, you know? And I said, I didn't see it in real life, but when I heard about it, I said, oh, that's not going to stand. That can't stand. They're going to
shot out of the sky.
Yeah, right. And before it was over, they had to apologize. He came back and apologized. Oh, I said it was shot out of the sky. I didn't mean that. Blah, 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 blah. You know, so.
Well, you know what they call a gaffe is? A gaffe is what when someone accidentally tells the truth in Washington, D.C.
Right. They call that a Kinsley gaffe, you know, where you the journalist Michael Kinsley described it, and it's a very accurate one. It's like, you know, when Obama says, you know, you didn't build that, or, you know, that sort of thing. Or
Michael Kinsley was a liberal who had a sense of humor.
Right. But a Kinsley gaffe, it makes total sense. It's when you accidentally tell the truth.
Well, Jack, you have anything else on your plate? Anything new coming up? Or
I'm working on a couple. You know, I do a lot of ghostwriting, and I'm working on a couple of projects, with pretty high end projects, but I'm not allowed to talk about them. So,
okay.
But there's that, and I am. You know, it's interesting with Trump now in the White House. It changes my my motivation. You know.
Mm-hmm.
So, because I know more about Obama and the Clintons than probably anyone in the United States. And for 8 years, I voted for Bear. So now I get to relax a little bit, you know. So we'll see what happens.
You've been denied your enemy. What are you going to do now?
Right? Yeah, no. I mean, they were actually good for business.
Yeah.
although the irony of the problem, you know, I wish they were good for business, because the problem was that, and this remains a problem, Tim, and you know this as well as anyone, is that the major media still are not doing their job. And although I was thinking today that, you know, the refreshing thing about having Trump in the White House is that you can criticize the president without being called a racist. You know,
that's
first
right.
For 8 years, you'll be able to do that, you know. So. Anyhow, that's where we stand today. So,
yeah,
but I appreciate you having me on, Tim. And if you want to do this again sometime, just let me know.
Yeah, listen, yeah, thank you for coming on. You have a lot of interesting titles in there.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. In fact, you know, what I've written about, I've realized now, these years later, now that I have a title, is fake news. I could do a fake news article every week on historic fake news. I wrote one last week on the Willie Horton story, which is fake. And then
I read that.
The whole Leonard Peltier thing, and that was fake. You know, there's the free Leonard Peltier movement. The guy's guilty of sin. He killed two FBI agents, point blank range. They used to be able to make this stuff up and get away with it. And now they're being held to account. And it's fun to see them squirm, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so. You know, 10 years ago, the incident in Chicago would not have been reported, period. You never would have known about it, you know.
Are you talking about the torture?
The guy, the mentally disabled guy, being white guy.
Yeah,
being
that's
beat up.
That's really disturbing. Yeah.
Yes.
You know, that's.
And, you know, and the only reason the major media are reporting it now is because the social media and the alternative media forced them to. You know,
yeah.
Too big a story to sit on. So, Benny, yeah, that's the way it rolls. And, Tim, you guys keep up the good work. And people like you who help keep the media honest, you know.
Well, thank you. It's, you know, like I said, you're doing the hard work. I'm just doing the reading. Right. That's the fun part. So, great. Well, listen, thank you.
And great questions, by the way. It's always fun to talk to someone who's read the book. You know,
Thanks. Yes, I want to thank you again. Thanks for coming on the show. It's great. It's nice to talk to a kind of a serious investigative journalist about these things, and sometimes focus on one issue. And that every now and then I like to do that. It is one of these fascinating, disturbing issues because. Well, you know, there's so many other cover-ups and scandals in history, and Zero on One is an example to see how these things are possible. If you dissect this one, you can see how it's possible, and it's
absolutely.
Not just it's not a crazy conspiracy theory. It's
everyone knows it's true. Everyone who's worked on the investigation knows it's true.
Yes.
Hey Tim, thanks a lot, though, sir. Let's keep in touch, okay?
Great. Yeah, good night. So long. Thanks a lot.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Sweet lady, running like a stream. You don't look back because you know your hands are clean. You make believe that the past was just a dream. You make believe the past was just a dream. Turn around, us where you've been, but you've been gone too long. Poor Eliza said you must begin again, and all the roads that you have walked are coming to an end. Well, I was your lover, but I thought I was your friend. I loved you, but I thought I was your friend. Turn around, oh, turn around, and I will sing for you a song. And I don't know just where you've been, but you've been gone too. Maybe you can find a little time to think of me. Won't you please remember what I tried so hard to be? Yeah, remember what I tried so hard to be. So turn around, oh, turn around, and I will sing for you a song.
Thank you.